This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Deep State Radio. This is David Rothkopf. I am your host, and joining me today on the episode in London, England, Corey Shockey, permanent holder of the Tiara of Optimism, and in at the Center for American Progress, their Vice President for National Security Studies, Kelly Magsiman, and at Georgetown University, our own Rosa Brooks, who is Associate Dean there at the School of Law. I was saying between conversations that we have before we go on the air, that sometimes I get harassed by various members of my family. and I get emails like this one, which I just got from my mother shortly before we began here, which says, "One wonders if it is not time to re-reveal that Stephen Miller is a Semitic anti-Semite, a very low life form, who had a grandmother who only spoke Yiddish, and revisit the Trump ancestors, notably his grandfather, a draft dodger, as he emigrated here and for a time amassed a lot of money as a purveyor to a latter-day gold rush of hotels and whorehouses." Oh, Mom. Mom, never forgetting Papa Fred Trump was a member of the KKK. This is my mother. And then she says, "But the sun is shining and the snow is melting." It's really, this is the kind of thing. Support that I get on our
show. I love it that you get trolled by your mom, David.
Yeah, well, trolled, wound up by my mom. But Rosa, I understand your dad sort of one-upped you with this whole thing.
He did.
That story.
Well, my dad, my dad actually made me a thorny crown of entropy for me to wear or display possibly on the mantle. He made it out of sticks and thorns, and it's decorated with all sorts of occult symbols, including the actual formula for entropy. And he handed it to me in this cardboard box. It was all sealed up. "Dad, I hope you're listening." And he said, "It's just a small present for you. Don't tell anyone because I don't want your siblings to be jealous or anything." I opened it. I said, "Dad, I don't think you've got anything to worry about." But no, I do now own an actual thorny crown of entropy made of wood.
Fantastic.
Wow. Happy Easter.
And I was wearing it because, well, yesterday, suitably on the day we're recording this, I say yesterday, but this year we had the strange confluence of Easter and April Fool's Day, which made it a perfect day for the thorny crown of entropy.
Can I say how much I loved Twitter for showing me people taking Brussels sprouts, coating them in chocolate and nuts, and wrapping them in gold foil to pass off to unsuspecting children as candy? I could not be prouder of those people.
No, they're in the middle of it right now.
Wow, that is really something. Kelly, does your family wind you up in the same way that Rosa and mine do, or have you been spared?
Oh,
kind of thing?
Yes, mine definitely wind me up. I have my parents. My dad lives out in Arizona. My mother lives north of Baltimore, and it's, you know, my mother is very much on the sort of liberal end of the spectrum. My father is very conservative, so I get treatment on both ends whenever I go home to visit. So they spin me up in different directions.
Yeah, I could imagine that. I was in Arizona last week, and we went to a rodeo. and you know, I mean, I'm sure this is evoking all sorts of imagery out there, but we actually went to a rodeo, and the amount of flags on horses and talk about our God-given rights to firearms was really kind of something.
I was just in Nashville, where I went to a Grand Ole Opry concert and to the Country Music Hall of Fame, David. So I can one up you there.
Go.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Oh, Corey, I went to a rodeo and Rosa went to the Grand Ole Opry, and you're the Republican.
And what are you doing? You're in old Europe.
Yeah.
So you, my friends, are going to have to work up to my level. The first money I earned was in cattle arbitraging. When I was a little kid, I would buy runt calves from the local dairies in my dusty little cow town, raise them on bottled milk, and auction them off at the county fair to earn my spending money.
Oh, my
money.
Goodness. Corey, do you have any left over?
Any money or any cattle?
Any cattle.
No, best to get rid of them young. Cattle are stupid and ornery.
Well, many of them could do a good job in the Trump administration, which leads me to my point. Kelly, once upon a time, I think when I first met you, actually, you were working in the Obama administration, and you had a job which, having written a couple of books about the NSC, was the one that I kept coming back to, which was that we needed to have a strategic planning capacity. And on a typical basis in the NSC, people come in and they talk about it. Brent Scowcroft said, this was the most important thing I was going to do. And then he said, and I never got around to it because things happen, you know. And inside, you know, inside the government, we talk about doing strategic planning, but it actually happens much less than people would think. And I want to talk a little bit from a strategic planning point of view, perhaps not from the point of view of the U.S. government, although it has implications, but from the point of view of other governments around the world. And I want to look out what might be a year or 2 years or 3 years. But something that has come up again and again in conversations I've been involved with is, what happens after Trump? How many of the things that Trump is doing with trade, with international institutions, with specific allies, whether it's Mexico or South Korea, with rivals like Russia or enemies like Russia, rivals like China, countries elsewhere in the world, what's going to happen the day after he goes? You know, how much of that's just going to snap back? And we're going to say, oops, never mind. You know, hey, Mexico, you know, he was crazy. Just forget about it. We're back to the way we used to be. And how much of that is going to linger? And what is going to actually have lasting consequences? Because to me, strategic planning for the rest of the world is going to involve figuring this out. And I was just thought I'd start with you and go around to everybody and just sort of talk a little bit about the day after Trump.
Folks overseas and who have very different reactions. Some of them will say, we'll never forget that you voted for, you know, that you elected Donald Trump. And that's going to have a lasting impact on how we think about the United States and what you stand for and your values. There are others who say, you know, we'll get through the next few years, you know, we'll figure it out, but don't reelect him. I do think there's probably a little bit of a 4 year versus 8 year question in terms of how much damage that he can do. But I think, you know, we're already starting to see that even within 4 years, a lot of damage can be done to sort of how allies perceive us, how the world perceives us, and not just, you know, perception, damage in perception, but potential material damage if, you know, for example, he decides to start a preventive war with North Korea or potentially get into another conflict, to get into conflict with the Iranians. So, I mean, I think there is a matter of timing. I think about this question a lot, and I think what's unfortunate about President Trump is that he's coming at precisely the worst possible moment in history, I think, for the United States, when we were already going through a transition internationally that was going to be difficult to navigate for any president, much less one who doesn't necessarily believe in the values that have defined American foreign policy for decades. And so, you know, it's sort of Trump pouring gasoline onto the fire. And, you know, in terms of coming out the other side, I think, you know, if the United States, you know, in my perfect world, Trump gets booted out of office one way or the other, and the United States returns in some way to a values-driven foreign policy. And when I say values, I mean democratic values. But will the world trust us? Will the world, you know, think that we can do that post-Trump, I think, is an open question. But, you know, if you're looking at the central, from a strategic planning perspective, if you're looking at the central struggle that's going to face the United States for the next couple decades, it's going to be, you know, the rise of illiberalism globally. And it's going to be basically fighting for liberalism in the context of that. And when you don't have a president that sort of understands the importance of liberal values, you're already kind of losing the game. So I think he can do a tremendous amount of damage between now and then. And from a planning perspective, I think we've got to be figuring out how to restore international faith in the United States, but also American faith in what we stand for in the world.
Well, Rosa, let me turn this to you. The day after Trump, what changes the day after Trump that's just related to Trump?
Well, I think that we begin to have a slightly more orderly decision-making process in the White House, whether we have a Republican coming in or whether we have a Democrat coming in. I think, you know, I think that we return to some semblance of process normalcy in the White House, and that's obviously a good thing, sort of independent of substance. But I actually just wanted to respond a little bit to your question to Kelly as well, and Kelly's comments. I actually think it would be a great and really important project to pull together a sort of some kind of group of interesting, smart people to do a sort of after Trump project to say, what are we going to need to do? What's going to need to be cleaned up? What is easy to fix? What is going to be hard to fix? You know, what's the agenda? What should get fixed first? What should get fixed second? You know, et cetera. Because I do think that the damage that this administration is doing to institutions, to norms, to policies, just across the board is so great that there is going to be a significant amount of cleaning up, again, whichever party ends up in the White House after the next round of presidential elections. And we better start thinking now, because if we don't, you know, we're going to lose opportunities. We're going to inadvertently cement some of the damage that's been done. I would actually, so I'm proposing this to Kelly in her position at CAP, not to mention to any of our listeners, our many influential listeners at their own little think tanks and big think tanks. You know, we should start, you guys should launch an after Trump project.
Yeah, I thought that's what we were doing right here, Rosa. But,
well, in a more, you know, in a slightly more organized way.
Well,
but we'll contribute.
It could hardly be more organized than this, but let's pick up on that, Corey. Let's assume that Rosa's idea is a good idea, since it was actually the idea behind this episode. And,
making it a great idea.
To make it great. And say, you know, where would you start? But, you know, I mean, what should the agenda be? Where, if you're giving advice to U.S. public policy people, what has Trump done that needs to be fixed soonest? What is second, third, as Rosa said?
So I love the idea, and I do think it's a really good thing for, in particular, American think tanks to be working on for two reasons. Reason one,
I think they could do it in conjunction with you guys, right? Because international think tanks need to be thinking the same thing or thinking about the same questions.
I imagine governments are already thinking about that question as they've tried to wrestle with how much to accommodate President Trump, I think, has a lot to do with how much they think he is accurately reflecting American public opinion. And versus how much is his own pulling rabbits out of his hat or talking off of the top of his head. So just to take one example that's actually going to be hard for folks, trade policy. Both major American political parties have been talking absolute nonsense on trade policy for quite a long time. Barack Obama in 2008 campaigned against NAFTA. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump opposed the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. So if you are a foreign government, what do you, it affects how you have to think about it if both American political parties are anti-trade. And everybody knows Clinton was lying about that, but she and Jake Sullivan would say it with a straight face time and time again. And so it makes the intellectual challenge of thinking, where do our interests overlap with American interests, and where should we be pushing back against places where they don't overlap, and how much of that failure to overlap is specific to this reckless president and his third-rate administration versus how much of it is accurately reflecting American sentiments as globalization mm-hmm. advances. I think it's a really important problem to build intellectual capital on. I also think it's a really hard problem. And we sometimes oversimplify the task by suggesting that you can separate Trump from the political forces that got him elected president in the United States. So here would be my priorities, though. The first one for me would be America's alliance commitments, because the countries that we have them to, I can't think of a single country with which we have an alliance relationship that believes it could defend its interests without American assistance, right? Not even the British believe they could achieve their national interests without American help. So that's the most important one, to be able to figure out how much of this is Donald Trump ricocheting around and wanting to feel like a celebrity with heads of state, Trump traveling through the White House, and how much is his weird appreciation and admiration for authoritarian governments versus how much is Americans losing their desire to be the rule makers and enforcers of the international order, and do they understand what a world that others set the rules in will be like for America? And how can we affect that understanding?
Well, those are good places to start. Rosa, before I turn back to Kelly, what are the other agenda items you would add?
Some of it I think is obviously symbolic, that there are a series of symbolically important statements that whoever becomes president, I think, will need to make that relate to both foreign policy and to domestic issues, statements about the U.S. unwillingness to tolerate fascism, Nazism, racism, various forms of intolerance that both internationally and domestically Trump has enabled and empowered. And I think that notwithstanding the importance of dealing in the longer term with the social forces that are behind Trump's election victory, as Corey said, which we will have to do, that some of the very first moves are going to be symbolic reassertions of American values. And I think it's that was a fairly easy list to put together, as Corey says, internationally, it's about the importance of alliances. It's about the importance of diplomacy. It's about the importance of democratic states that respect human rights, standing up for those values and respecting those values themselves and working together to try to foster those values, globally speaking. I think that then there's a series of sort of institutional reforms that are going to be harder and more complicated, but that also sort of do go to, some day one symbolic statements, such as reasserting the importance of a professionalized, nonpartisan civil service and military, and making it clear that civil servants will not be penalized for speaking about the facts as they understand them, that is, in fact, part of their job, and then trying to undo some of the numerous executive orders and regulatory actions that have created a climate in which it is harder and harder for civil servants to operate in the way they're supposed to be operating. then I think there's a much, you know, it would take us much too long to go through the long list of, you know, sort of second or day two things that we need to start unraveling, whether it comes to immigration policy, to trade policy, et cetera. But that might be the subject of a future episode.
Well, we're not quite done yet. Kelly, as you are now a think tank professional, and as you would consider this kind of thing of sort of the day after Trump, what should our priorities be post-Trump? How would you tackle it?
Well, I think I'd agree with both Corey and Rosa, what they said so far. I think the trade issue, frankly, the global economic issue, not just the trade issue, I think is an important one to tackle. Because I do think there are a number of Americans who, you know, trade is good overall, but there are people that are hurt by trade. And I think we've got to figure out better ways through domestic policy to figure out how to protect those people, or how to take care of them, or train them differently, or whatnot, or have the social safety net in place so that the disruptive effects of trade, you know, don't have as much of an impact. And so I think it's as much of an economic policy, domestic economic policy review as it is a foreign international trade policy review. So I think that's important. I think the allies, I think, is top of my list, frankly, and all the sort of assertions that Rosa was talking about. But also, I mean, I think we have to layer in great power competition and what, you know, we think the United States should be doing at home and abroad to position itself well for the transition that we're in. And I think this is more, I think, relevant to the China challenge than it is to the Russia challenge. I think the Russia one is somewhat different, but in China in particular, we have not, I think, woken up to the scale of the China challenge, both economic and security. And so we need to be doing kind of a soup to nuts look at what are the elements of American national power that we want to have endure, where are the places that we're going to have to make adjustments, what are the decisions we're going to have to make as it relates to priorities to be able to compete effectively with China on a global scale. And that's everything from how much we invest in our education system, how much R&D investment we make, to how we work with our allies overseas to try to limit China's ability to draft off the international system. So I think it's, you know, both allies, it's trade, it's the things we have to do at home, but it's also how we're going to try to position the United States in the context of that broader global shift in power that I think is occurring. I mean, we frankly, I think you guys all know this, but post-Cold War, I think we all got a little lazy in terms of thinking about the longevity of American power and the sort of the evolution and the natural evolution of democracy. I think we are facing a democratic backsliding globally, and we've got to figure out what we're going to do about that. So those are the places I would start, and we are starting some of that here at CAP, actually. So, that's where I would begin.
Okay, let me just sort of take it a step further, or let me propose something, for example. My sense is that all this sort of insanity about the wall goes away the day after Trump leaves. My sense is that a lot of the insane picking a fight with Mexico and Canada goes away the day after Trump leaves. My sense is that the complexity of the China relationship lingers and needs to be dealt with. My sense is that, you know, the State Department is going to take a long time to recover from the gutting that it's had. And so even if the policies change the day after, this is going to go on. Corey, can you suggest, you know, a country or a couple of countries where policy is likely to just change the next day because it's a change of the president?
I think you're exactly right that Mexico policy will change immediately. I actually think Germany policy will also change immediately. President Trump has been weirdly antagonistic towards the German chancellor. And I think her policies of emphasizing the values equation that Kelly mentioned are part of it. But I also think the president just basically has a problem with women. And and so,
you think?
I think Russia policy will change. The administration's Russia policy has been so much better than one would imagine, given the president's personal proclivities. But I think stopping talking encouragingly and positively about Vladimir Putin and congratulating him on his election.
He is a very handsome magnetic man, Corey.
It's horrible to hear the president congratulate Sisi and congratulate Putin and congratulate President Xi. So I think that will stop immediately. What else? Where else do I think it will change really fast? Where do you think it will change best, David?
Yeah, David.
Well, as I said, I think it's going to change in this hemisphere fast. I think it's going to probably change pretty quickly on a bunch of these issues associated with refugees and immigration. I think that it's going to change pretty quickly in Israel and the Gulf. It's not that the U.S. is going to go from being sort of blindly supportive of some states to being in direct opposition. But I think Bibi Netanyahu thinks he's got a free pass from Trump and he can do whatever he wants. And I think the next president of the United States, regardless of the political party, is going to have a more nuanced view. Whether it's the Obama antipathy or not is going to be a different issue. But it could go back that far. If a Democrat replaces Trump and Netanyahu continues things such as he is doing in Gaza, I think that you could have a close to 180-degree swing in that relationship. And again, you look at the Iran deal. I think the while there has been a lot of sort of Republican opposition to the deal, a new president, particularly the Democratic president, you're going to likely see a very strong swing backwards. And in fact, I think one of the tricks for a lot of foreign countries is going to be, how do you stretch this out? How do you postpone things until some future administration can deal with them? And that, by the way, may be also the trick in terms of the North Korean negotiation, started on a path now, but the Trump team is focused on denuclearization. There are other teams that are likely to come in that may view that as an unrealistic goal, because it is an unrealistic goal, and that there may be an entirely different view there. So I think on the institutional issues, particularly within the U.S. government, there's going to be a lot of repair work to be done. But I think most U.S. relationships are going to change fairly dramatically as a result of all of this. Does that make sense to you, Kelly, or do you think I'm just, fine with that?
Yeah, I do think that there are some of our friends overseas are not going to fully return immediately. I think actually Europe might be a harder nut to crack. I mean, on the one hand, any future U.S. president is going to be 1,000 times greater than President Trump as it relates to Europe. But if you watch what's happening in Europe, and especially in Central Europe, there are some similar drivers and dynamics that are occurring in places like Hungary and Poland that, I wonder how much of a return to sort of normalcy in the U.S.-European relationship there is going to be. I think they're going to be enduring challenges there. And of course, we've sort of forgotten about Brexit for now. Although Corey's not, she's living in Europe right now, but that's still on the horizon. So, we could still be swimming in the wake of that in the sort of transition period of the U.S. presidency. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, I think there are a number of allies, personal, friends who have told me that they'll never fully believe that we're reliable again. And then that's the part that I think we've got to figure out now, how to not just sort of snap back, but to how to have an enduring, more sustainable relationship with our allies where they believe they can trust us, for the long run.
Well, then let me flip this as we go to a sort of our last round of these questions here to you, Rosa, and say, what do you think is going to be the most lasting effect of the Trump presidency?
That's a good question. I don't know, right? I mean, I'm torn between two views, you know, one of which is that Trump is going to turn out to be a flash in the pan, that once he's gone, there will be a rapid course correction, and that there won't be an enduring effect, except in a, you know, a small way of this becomes, you know, yet another little pebble tossed into the waters, creating ripples of, maybe the U.S. is not so reliable. Maybe the U.S. is not so great. Maybe we should hedge our bets for other states. That's one possibility. I think that is possible. You know, that we and I especially perhaps are very good at coming up with these apocalyptic scenarios, in which, you know, this is just the tipping point in a, you know, catastrophic slide towards, you know, World War III, national destruction, et cetera. But I think it is possible, you know, on the what does not kill us makes us strong theory of the world, that there really isn't a big impact in the end. You know, there was a big impact for individual human beings while Trump was there, you know. But once he's gone and we get back to normal is quite possible. So, but on the other hand, I'm perfectly capable of coming up with apocalyptic visions that say that even if Trump is gone, that we do get past some tipping point, that there's both a tipping point, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere, you know, towards more authoritarian, less democratic forms of populism around the globe, and that we cannot recover from that, that in the U.S., our own democracy is seen as so utterly tarnished and so permanently tarnished that makes it impossible for us to be ever again considered a reliable leader or even a reliable partner with other states, and that indeed the fomenting by Trump, by Bannon, by Stephen Miller, et cetera, of all sorts of divisive politics by you know, empowering straight out racism, xenophobia, misogyny, you name it, it potentially gets us to the brink of you know, in the most apocalyptic version, some version of a civil war, you know, a real civil conflict that we can't walk back from that. And we see rhetoric to that effect on the far right, of, you know, we'll have to fight, et cetera, when the liberals with their soy lattes come to try to take away our guns, you know, we'll just have to fight them. So I honestly have no idea whether my apocalyptic imaginings are just goofy and silly and we can all say, oh, they're goofy and silly and not worry about them, and we're more likely to get to the no effect, or whether we should be seriously digging our silos a little bit deeper.
Well, I know where you tend in that regard, as do all of us, which is why they're here. There's a certain kind of survivalist cult to the listeners of Deep State Radio that are looking to you for clues.
Who would have thought that I would lead a survivalist cult?
Well, you will lead it, and you will wear your heavy crown of entropy. But Corey, you know, one of the things that we come back to on a regular basis on this show is you providing a little bit of historical perspective. And when I think about Rose's question, I think about this overall question. I do ask myself, at what point in American history has there ever been a president that was a one-off, that didn't represent a deeper underlying trend, who was a real anomaly? Can you think of any?
Oh, yeah, I can think of lots of them. Most American presidents have terms that are completely undistinguished, and yet they got elected president. So when you elect an American president that is inconsequential, it typically means you're happy with the way things are. And when people are unhappy with the way things they are, with things the way they are, they tend to bounce around and keep turning keys in the lock until they finally have somebody with enough leadership. The bad news is We have actually had a very serious precursor to Russia, to Rosa's concern, right? That's the run-up to the Civil War, where you have five or six genuinely terrible American presidents who lack the ability or the courage to tackle the problems that the country is frothing about. And it's not until you get Abraham Lincoln's clarity of vision and decency and genuine greatness that the problem, the perversion of slavery in America gets solved, and it gets solved by force of arms. And so we do have a chilling precedent to the country being unhappy, political leaders lacking the leadership to bravely address the country's problems, and us sinking further and further into the mire.
Well, but all of those cases speak to my point of some form of continuity. I was really sort of getting at the fact that it seems like anomalous presidents are unusual, that they tend to represent a bit of a trend. And Kelly, as I sort of come here, as we come to the end of this thing, I think that the complementary question to the whole series of questions we've been asking is, where in Trump do you see continuity? For example, I think a lot of people out there in the world would say post-Bush, post-Iraq, you saw first Obama and then Trump being loath to get engaged overseas, perhaps leaning backwards a little more than we had leaned forwards in the past. And so that Trump may be seen as having some continuity with Obama in that regard. Do you have other areas where you see Trump as a symptom of something deeper and likely to continue?
I guess, you know, in terms of continuity, yes, I think you're right. There's, I think, a growing swell of American, you know, popular feeling against getting more deeply involved in wars overseas. And in that sense, I guess, yes, he does represent that continuity, although I think that's more his team than it is him. You know, I actually think he might be more of an anomaly. In fact, I was toying with an idea of writing a piece called The Last Presidency at one point, because I think he has forever changed the presidency, the office of the presidency, to a point where I think Americans now, or at least maybe this is my perspective, I don't think we'll ever look at that office the same way. And in some ways it's lost its mystique, its power, its greatness. And I think it's in part because of what Trump has been doing as he's been sitting in the Oval Office. And I don't know, I guess I wonder if our friends overseas feel the same way about the American presidency. And it's, you know, so that's sort of the negative side of things. On the upside, sort of to the theme of this podcast, you know, I think our institutions have demonstrated a certain level of resiliency that, you know, even I didn't expect, whether it's the deep state the court system. I mean, even Congress, as much as I would like to throw sticks at Congress, I think they have been a constraining factor on the president. So, you know, it's that gives me a little bit of hope. But I think in terms of, you know, him being an anomaly or a continuity, I think he's profoundly different. And I think his impact on the presidency is going to be significant.
Well, that's unsettling. But it is an appropriate place to wrap up this discussion. I do think this is an issue that requires greater exploration, and I support Rosa's call for further discussions in this area. I'm really, really glad to have had Kelly and Corey and Rosa here today with the rest of us in the land of Deep State Radio to talk about all of this. But next week, I will actually be coming to you from another project of our organization, which is called Culture Summit, which is going to be in Abu Dhabi. It brings together something like 600 people from 90 countries who are involved in using culture to advance positive change in the world, whether it's fighting extremism, fighting climate change, empowering women, or preserving heritage, and we have artists performing in every art form, from film to theater to poetry to dance to all forms of music, as well as policymakers and others. And every year we bring together these people for 5 days. And so next week's Deep State Radio, I at least will be coming to you from Abu Dhabi. Corey will probably be in London. Rosa will probably be in a silo someplace. We will continue that. And then I go from there to China. So I will do 2 episodes from China. And so hopefully this will provide some different perspectives in all of this. If you're interested in Culture Summit, look for it on the internet at culturesummitabudhabi.com or on Twitter, because it's very, very interesting event. And there's also a lot of kind of good music and other kinds of performances that will come out of it that you might want
to
watch.
David, how come you never take us with you to all these exotic places you go to?
I didn't think you would be interested.
Yeah, David.
I thought you spent all the spare time stacking, you know, MR.
I do. Somebody needs to take me out of my silo.
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, you were in Turkey not too long ago. You were fairly close to all of it. But we will have to take this Deep State Radio show on the road in any event. We've been getting a lot of people saying, let's do a few live. We've got some thoughts on that. And so hopefully when I get back from China, I'm going to really focus on this, and we're going to have some announcements regarding where we may do some Deep State Radio here live. Obviously, you know, some on Corey's doorstep there. She will bring us to Buckingham Palace, where she is, you know, regular guest, or some such place. We will, or will you, I think you're originally going to take us to the George Papadopoulos pub, right? That will be one of these broadcasts that we've got. But we're going to do a bunch of things like that. And I just encourage everybody to stand by as we do it. But thanks again for this episode, and we look forward to joining you in the coming weeks.
Deep State Radio is a production of the Deep State Radio Network, a division of TRG Interactive Media. Our podcast today was produced in cooperation with Goat Rodeo Productions and was supervised by Ian Enright. Join us again for another episode of Deep State Radio. If you don't, we know where to find you.